Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the national security implications of the anti-Muslim Islamophobia expressed by Donald Trump on Monday at a rally on the USS Yorktown, where he called for a total complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States and went on to say that we are going to have more 9/11s unless we ban Muslims from America. Lawrence Korb, a former Assistant Secretary of Defense during the Reagan administration and the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction, joins us to discuss the vital role American Muslims play in the United States Armed Forces and the aid and comfort that Trump's attacks on Muslims are providing Daesh, the self-declared Islamic State. Then we'll look into the impact that Trump's hate speech is having on American Muslims and speak with Ambassador Islam Siddiqui, the highest-ranking American Muslim in the Clinton and Obama administrations, who is the president and co-founder of the American Muslim Institution. We will discuss the latest public policy polling survey that finds Trump is far and away the front-runner in North Carolina, where 67% of his backers want a national database on Muslims, 62% believe Trump's lies about Muslims celebrating 9/11, and 51% want to shut down mosques, while 44% want Islam outlawed. Then finally, we'll examine the arguments before the Supreme Court today that challenge the very underpinning of the one-person, one-vote core of American democracy. Elizabeth Wydra, the Chief Counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, who was in the Supreme Court today, joins us to explain the consequences of a ruling in favor of the plaintiffs, the same conservative activists in a number of Supreme Court cases brought by Ed Blum, that would diminish the clout of urban voters and increase the power of rural, usually Republican voters. And joining us now from Germany is Lawrence Korb, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense from 1981 to 1985 during the Reagan administration and is the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Korb.
Nice to be with you.
And I wanted to get a local reaction to Donald Trump's Islamophobic policy pronouncements that have shocked a lot of people here in the United States. And I imagine they're not sitting well with the U.S.'s NATO allies. I mean, obviously, I'd also like to talk to you about the national security implications of what Donald Trump is proposing. So let's begin with the local reaction there in Germany.
Well, I think people are so disappointed in the United States that somebody like this, who espouses values that are not American, and not only that, but undermine our security and their security, could be considered a possible nomination of one of our two major political parties.
And is there any sense that a lot of the other candidates running, even though Trump is way ahead of the others and he seems to keep climbing in the polls, surely you can't let Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, and Ben Carson off the hook. They've also made Islamophobic pronouncements.
Yeah, unfortunately, all of the candidates said something in one way or the other. Even Jeb Bush, and certainly he should know better given, you know, what his father and brother said. You know, he talked about only letting Christians into the United States. I think they're generally very, very shocked and disappointed that the party of Reagan, for example, who gave amnesty to over 2 million illegal immigrants, and the President Bush, who after 9/11 was very clear that we're not, you know, this was not caused by, you know, a Muslim religion, and we're not at war with Islam. They're disappointed that the Republican Party has strayed so far from that. And they really are concerned that one of them could be the next president of the United States.
So as a former Assistant Secretary of Defense during the Reagan administration, Larry Korb,
Obviously, back then, that was before, although, of course, the Reagan administration did intervene in Lebanon and the Marines were killed. And then shortly thereafter, the attention was shifted to Grenada. But by and large, the obsession about the Middle East has basically been in the last two or three decades, starting with President Clinton, or the focus, I should say, with the Middle East. But what's your understanding of the role that Muslims play in the armed services? My sense is that they're invaluable. One, that they speak the local languages, and two, they have the cultural understanding that's necessary to engage the local people, because in these asymmetrical wars, in these subnational conflicts that we are afflicted with today, it would seem that the hearts and minds issue is as important as anything. I mean, you cannot bomb the Islamic State out of existence because you're essentially up against an ideology, but you can undermine and attack the ideology.
Well, there's no doubt about the fact that, you know, Muslims in this country are very patriotic and thousands of them serve in the military, undermines the narrative of groups like ISIL that this is the second coming of the Crusades. And as you pointed out, they've been very effective in helping us when we get into these Muslim countries, whether it's Iraq, whether it's Afghanistan, and now in Syria, to help us understand the local culture. Most of the young men and young women who volunteer for the military simply don't have that background. And so without them, we would not be effective. And that's why this idea they're at war with Muslims. No, we're at war with a group of radical people who seek to undermine not only us, but their own civilization.
And again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Korb, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a senior advisor to the Center of Defense Information. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration and is the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction. Well, but this candidate, Donald Trump, has already offended the Latinos, and there's certainly a lot of Latinos in the armed forces. And now he's moving on to offend or actually shut the door on the Muslims. But even his pronouncements about building a wall and his statements denigrating and insulting Latinos, it would seem that he's gone much, much further in his proposals to ban Muslims from entering this country.
Well, and again, if you look at Hispanic Americans on a per capita basis have earned more Medal of Honors than any other group. Again, without them, getting into the military, the volunteer military would not work. And what he does is he undermines what we fight for. We fight for the right of every man, woman, or child to decide his or her own destiny. And the idea that he would say, well, no, we're not going to let these people in. And unfortunately, he's tapping into a strain that unfortunately we've had in our past. You may remember that right before we got involved in World War II, a group of Jewish refugees tried to land in Florida, and they wouldn't let them. And they said, oh, they were communists and fascists and everything like that. And these people went back to Germany, and most of them were annihilated.
No, indeed. I recently interviewed Martin Goldsmith, who wrote a recent book about it. His relatives were among those that perished in the death camps. But specifically, Larry Korb, the Pentagon spokesperson said today, in response to Donald Trump's proposal to ban Muslims from entering the United States, the Pentagon statement was, anything that bolsters ISIL's narrative and pits the United States against the Muslim faith is certainly not only contrary to our values, but contrary to our national security. So is that going to resonate, do you think, with the conservative Americans who support Donald Trump? And he clearly does have a lot of support.
Well, unfortunately, it will take a while for them to realize that this struggle against groups like ISIL are not going to be won militarily. They're going to have to be won by undermining their ideology, and making statements like that feeds into the narrative. Hopefully, people will come around to see that. Unfortunately, Trump is tapping into a strain that we've had throughout our history, the so-called know-nothings, people who didn't want Catholics to come into this country. And hopefully somebody in the Republican Party, a John Kasich or something, will rise above this and demonstrate that that's not the way to do things.
Well, indeed, the Pentagon spokesperson went on to say many men and women in uniform today are of the Muslim faith who are serving the country patriotically, and that the U.S. is working with Muslim nations right now. And we want to, in essence, take the fight to ISIL with the help of Muslims around the world. So that ought to be an argument that resonates with pro-military conservatives in this country. It's pretty clear from the polls that nobody, whether on the left or the right in this country, wants American boots on the ground anymore in the Middle East. They're sick and tired of that. So, but the U.S. is working, the special forces are working with local forces, and in particular the Kurds, who are also Muslims. So, again, you can't insult the people that you're depending upon to do the fighting for you.
No, you can't. And I think that if this Trump may have gone one step too far, because even Republicans are upset about his thing about not letting people in this country who are Muslims, even American citizens, not only illegal and unconstitutional and violates international law, but it violates everything that we stand for. And you would hope that people in the now Trump having gone this too far would rise up against him and, you know, put this chapter behind us. Because if we don't, it's going to be more and more difficult for us to be able to accomplish our objectives in the Middle East.
Well, but the thing that's puzzling, though, is that all of the political pundits have been waiting for the longest time for Trump to go too far and to self-destruct. And there have been many prior occasions where they thought that his outrageous statements had crossed the line and he would therefore be shunned as a result. And unfortunately, the opposite has happened. So I think one has to be a little bit trepidatious about declaring this guy dead on arrival after this latest outburst, simply based upon the previously outrageous statements that he's made that have not disqualified him with the voters on the in the Republican primary, but boosted his poll numbers.
Well, again, there's no doubt about the fact that, at least in the polls, this hasn't hurt him. But I think there's a big difference between what people who are asked a question because they're frustrated with a lot of things that are happening in the country say, you know, this is somebody who, you know, is against the establishment, has caused us these problems. But it's a big difference when you actually go in and vote. If you go back and you look, you know, how well Herman Cain was doing. And even if you go back to 2008, at this time, Rudy Giuliani was first and the late former Senator Fred Thompson was second. So I think when people, you know, get into vote, whether it's the caucuses or the New Hampshire primary, they're going to say, well, it's one thing to say we like him. It's another thing to think of him, you know, putting our lives and the lives of our families at risk by putting him into the office.
Well, I guess something has certainly prompted Dick Cheney to come forward and denounce Trump's remarks as going against everything that we stand for. And the new Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, also went out of his way to say that it's not just that the Republican Party doesn't stand for what Trump is advocating. The United States does not stand for what Trump is advocating. So there's at least been some pushback from some of the candidates. Of course, the one candidate who's being quite mum on this whole thing is Senator Cruz. It's pretty clear that he's hoping to pick up Trump's voters, is he not?
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. I think he hopes that when Trump goes over the line, which he may have done now, that they'll go to Cruz, who, while he is anti-establishment, you know, he's an elected senator and, you know, hasn't made a lot of the extreme statements that, you know, Trump has made. And I'm sure that's his political strategy. I mean, he was the least critical today of Trump's comments.
Well, but what does that say about him? He is, in a sense, remaining silent on this outrageous Islamophobic racism. At the same time, presumably for tactical reasons, but at the same time, he knows better. So to my mind, I think he could make the case that Cruz is actually worse than Trump. Trump at least is laying it out there on the line, whereas Cruz is sort of waiting in the wings to reap the benefit of Trump's demise and reap those votes from the very same racist Islamophobes that Trump is pandering to.
Well, there's no doubt that appears to be his strategy, but again, I don't think it will be successful, because in the end, remember Winston Churchill said, we always kind of do a lot of the wrong things before we end up doing the right thing. And I think, you know, I don't think he will be the person that survives either once people began to get into, all of the primaries. He could, win. Remember Rick Santorum won, the first Republican primaries 4 years ago. So a lot of times the people who start out don't do well because, again, Americans say, well, wait a second, do we really want this? Do we really believe in what this man or woman happens to be saying at this time?
Well, just back to the military, Lawrence Korb, the fellow that's the chief foreign policy advisor to Dr. Ben Carson is a former lieutenant general in the Army who started, when he left the military, the military ministry, which attempts to proselytize the military into accepting Jesus Christ as the Savior, essentially trying to convert our soldiers, sailors, and airmen into fundamentalist Christians, with more than overt overtones of Islamophobia as well in these appeals. So from your understanding of the military, do we have a problem with Christian proselytizing, often at the expense of Muslims?
No, I don't think so. I think, in fact, he was forced out of the military because of the positions that he took. Now, obviously, he had been in for quite a while before he made those positions public. But no, I don't think so. I think the people who've been in the Middle East, who these brave men and women who've been fighting our wars for this, for these last almost 15 years now, they understand how important it is to have, people on their side who understand the culture and the region, not only members of the armed forces, but people in those areas that they work with. I mean, we've taken in 100,000 Iraqi refugees, most of them as a result of pushing by the people who work with them over military people who work with them over there.
Well, Lawrence Korb, I thank you for joining us. I appreciate your time from Germany.
Okay, great. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Korb, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration and is the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorist Tyrants and Weapons of Mass Destruction. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the impact that Trump's hate speech is having on American Muslims.
You risk exciting me. Once in Germany, someone said nine. Once in Germany, someone said nine.
To send someone away, got my back covered. Said, how you been all led astray? Come, let's count its ups. They lead you to the race where no one's asked them to.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Ambassador Islam Siddiqui, a former U.S. Undersecretary of Agriculture and the chief U.S. agricultural negotiator, who was the highest-ranking American Muslim in the Clinton and Obama administrations. He is currently senior advisor in the Global Food Security Project at the Center for Strategic International Studies and the president and co-founder of the American Muslim Institution. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador Islam Siddiqui.
Thank you very much for having me.
And on Monday, the Republican frontrunner in the Republican presidential primaries, Donald Trump, called for a total complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States. He did so at a rally on the USS Yorktown, a famous iconic American warship, in Mount Pleasant, South Carolina. And he went on to say, it's common sense and we have to do it. We have no choice. We have no choice. We can't live like this. It's going to get worse and worse. You're going to have more World Trade Centers. Now, touching on 9/11, of course, is about the most raw nerve that you can touch on the American people. So to equate you and all your fellow Muslim Americans with 9/11 seems to me to be a really monstrous insult. What's your reaction?
Firstly, I think for Mr. Trump to be making these outrageous remarks, if it was just limited to dealing with the immigration where he wants to have a better vetting process for the refugees coming here, I can understand because after the attack in San Bernardino, people are nervous and they want to make sure that our borders are safe and we take only people who are going to be law-abiding citizens of and immigrants in this country. But what he has said by lumping all Muslims, saying he wants to stop entry of any Muslims coming to us, I think this is something which is not only un-American, is unconstitutional because there is no religious test in order to provide entry to a person and how you're going to implement even if there was an unconstitutional ban.
Well, but by evoking 9/11 and there's going to be more World Trade Centers, he's effectively saying that the Muslim American population and adding to it increases our chances of being attacked. It's a way of suggesting that all American Muslims are, in effect, out to destroy the very country. I mean, I guess he doesn't understand that people have been coming to this country for centuries because it's a haven for people escaping hideous conditions, whether they be in Europe or the Middle East, as is the current situation in Syria. So, to my mind, it doesn't get much more inflammatory than that.
I think trying to divide Americans based on religion, this is something, as I said, is un-American. We have been welcoming immigrants from all over the world. And by the way, as you said, Muslims have been living in this country for centuries. And for him to be actually capitalizing on the fears of the people in starting to make statements which are going to be unhelpful in terms of our winning the war against ISIS. I fully agree that we have to be concerned and we are at war with ISIS and we have to do to defeat this hateful, barbaric ideology. But lumping all 1.6 billion Muslims into this together is actually is going to be very hard in terms of all the consequences. We do trade trillions of dollars of trade with Malaysia, Indonesia, and 55 other Muslim countries. We are the world leader in terms of trade and other foreign policy coordination. Is Mr. Trump saying that those officials coming here to the United Nations or people visiting for trade reason or students, thousands of students who come from Muslim countries, guess what? They are our best ambassadors when they go back because they learn the tolerant and multicultural and ideology and the philosophy of this country. So I think that's the best way we can affect a global society which is values human rights and abides by them.
And again, I'm speaking with Ambassador Islam Siddiqui, who's a former U.S. Undersecretary of Agriculture and the chief U.S. agricultural negotiator, who was the highest-ranking American Muslim in the Clinton and Obama administrations. He is currently senior advisor in the Global Food Security Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and he's the president and co-founder of the American Muslim Institution. And you mentioned earlier that Muslims have been coming to this country as immigrants for hundreds of years. It's worth noting that was, after all, a Muslim who was responsible for Christopher Columbus discovering the Americas in the first place, his navigator.
If I may also add one more point, Morocco was the first country to recognize a nascent democracy, which is United States of America. So I think for a Muslim country, 200 plus years ago, was the first country to recognize United States of America. So these are the kind of relationship we have, and I think what Mr. Trump is trying to do is destroy the fabric of international relations and cooperation America needs with Muslim countries in order to defeat ISIS. And we American Muslims actually want to work with U.S. government officials and law enforcement officials to spot people who might be radicalized. So I think there are ways for Mr. Trump to engage with us, and I, on this show, want to invite him to meet with us, and I'll lead that delegation to meet with him, how we can work together in defeating ISIS. But for God's sake, do not try to bring the loyalty in question of American Muslims, because we have been living here and we are law-abiding citizens, whether we're thousands of doctors, lawyers, IT professionals. And I think what Mr. Trump is doing is actually bringing this hateful message, which is not for the good of America.
But Ambassador Siddiqui, in meeting with Donald Trump, you still have to deal with the fact that there's a very alarming new poll from North Carolina from the PPP that underscores the appeal of Trump's anti-Islamic bigotry and Islamophobia amongst Republican voters or primary voters. The latest public policy polling survey finds that Trump is the front runner in North Carolina, and he's backed by one-third of GOP voters. That's double the support for the second-place person, which is Ted Cruz, at 16%. And according to the PPP data and analysis, Trump's Islamophobia is a central feature of his appeal to his supporters. Among Trump's backers, 67% support creating a national database of Muslims. 62% believe the discredited story that Arabs in New Jersey cheered as the Twin Towers fell on 9/11. And more than half, 51%, want to shut down mosques. And a full 44% believe Islam should be outlawed. So you don't just have a problem with Donald Trump. You have a problem with Donald Trump's supporters.
Well, I think the best way I can respond to that, I am very fully much aware of what you said, but if he's using this as a gimmick to get his popularity of inciting these crowds, that is not the American way. This is not the way. In my 52 years in this country, I came as a student and then became a naturalized citizen. Three of my children were born and raised there. And point I'm making is this thing. I've never seen this toxic environment which Mr. Trump is creating. And I hope Republican Party and his other Republican candidates will use whatever influence is that this is not the American way of dealing with winning elections. He should be doing this thing. He's a successful businessman. He's acumen in business. If you are to emphasize that, that's one thing. But for him to spread a hateful ideology, actually he makes is giving more ammunition to ISIS by making these irresponsible statements.
So in terms of the work that you do as president and co-founder of the American Muslim Institution, I mean, it sounds like all American Muslims have a tough road ahead. And I've have many Jewish American friends who always get annoyed and bristle at the idea that they have to automatically be associated with the State of Israel, which is, as you know, is run by a very right-wing leader, Netanyahu. Yeah. And most American Jews are quite liberal, and two-thirds of them are liberal Democrats. So they don't like the idea that they are suddenly being held responsible for Israel. And I imagine, as you, as a Muslim American and your fellow Muslims, don't want to be held responsible for the politics of the countries that you left as well.
I agree with you, and I think this is we need to have a conversation about this, and I think the best way I can say, does it really matter whether a young man goes into a church in South Carolina and kills nine worshippers, as it happened a few months ago, or a couple in San Bernardino in California killing 14 innocent Americans. I think we need to look at the causes of radicalization and how we deal with this thing. So I think we as Americans have a challenge here, and with the government officials, law enforcement officials, with the help of Muslim American community, I think if we want to make our borders safer and our society more, harmonious and peaceful, I think Muslim Americans will be the first one to come step to the table and talk about that. But I think demonizing them is not going to get us here. That actually is a victory for ISIS, in my opinion.
So, but what can Muslims do, though, in the sense that it's pretty clear that you do have the Islamic State or Daesh that operates in the name of Islam? They are the pretenders to a new caliphate. And you also have the current occupiers, if you will, of the caliphate, the House of Saud and the Wahhabis in this relationship that they have. And many Muslim scholars that I've spoken to said that there's not a lot of difference between the ideology of the Wahhabis and this and the Salafists in the Islamic State. So what is the influence of Saudi Arabia in terms of American Muslim teachings and thinkings? And are they a potent force? And if, as many argue, there's not enough pluralism within Islam itself in Saudi Arabia because of the influence of the Wahhabis, it used to be Mecca and Medina were full of all kinds of tremendous cross-section of Muslim beliefs. There are about 70-plus sects in the Islamic faith. So it's not one monotheistic, if you will, block. But my understanding is that the Saudis have taken the religion in that direction, away from pluralism. Is that something that you would accept?
Ian, I think there's sects in other religions, whether it be Christianity and Hinduism and others. So it's not Islam is not unique in that respect. And I have to tell you, when I came to the U.S. 52 years ago, I did not know the difference or even care for it, whether someone was a Shia or Sunni. Labels Salafist and Wahhabis, I think those are things which were regional and specific to a country. So I think by and large, in my exposure to Muslim community, American Muslim community, I travel a lot, and I have to tell you, Muslims in America actually predominantly subscribe to a modern version of Islam, and whatever ideologies you mentioned, these are something which are being practiced there. But I have to tell you, to be objective, I don't think we should be comparing Saudi Arabia with ISIS, because Saudi Arabia, although it's a conservative society, but guess what? They are not advocating people killing people in the name of religion and going to other countries and recruiting people to wage war. I think what needs to be done, the need of the day is for the U.S. government working with the Muslim countries in the Middle East to launch a coalition built just like George Bush Sr. did in terms of getting rid of the occupation of Kuwait. I think we need to get rid of this barbaric ideology, which is called ISIS or ISIL or Daesh. And I think this is where is the number one challenge for us. I think for that reason, I tell Mr. Trump, let's focus on the danger we face from this ideology, but let's not try to stigmatize American Muslims because they are your best allies.
So do you think, though, in terms of outreach to the rest of the American population that has distorted and sometimes ignorant attitudes and understandings of Islam and of Muslims, what can be done? I mean, perhaps the Quran itself should be made more available to the broader population, and maybe there should be a guidebook to understand what the Quran is really about, as opposed to the expropriation of the Quran by these murderous, marauding mob known as Daesh.
our religious leaders have to do a better job in terms of some of the work, I must say, is going on in terms of interfaith outreach. After 9/11, there's been more interfaith outreach among Muslims with other religious faith-based communities. We need to do more. We need to do more in terms of getting the facts out about this Muslims and Islam. And I think we need to essentially disconnect this cause and effect relationship. If something happened in the Middle East, that it should automatically should be reflected upon on the Muslims in America, because this is something which I think we need to do more in the Muslim American community. Also, in terms of our religious leaders, you know, trying to guide our youth and working with them and make sure that with the ease these days, with the access to internet and all this, you know, we are able to do a better job of reaching out to our youth in terms of the Islamic faiths. And I think the best way I can say is, you know, I mean, this one admonition in the Quran, if you kill one person, innocent person, you have killed the whole humanity. This is not any different than the Judaism and other religion. So where does ISIS get this ideology of killing people in the name of religion? And that's why it's an affront to all Muslims, and especially American Muslims, what's going on in Syria and northern Iraq.
Well, just in closing, Ambassador Siddiqui, is anything specifically that could be done if you take two of the most recent examples with the Syed Farouk out here in San Bernardino and the Tennessee shooter who killed the American serviceman in Chattanooga? In many ways, their profiles are similar. They both had abusive parents, fathers, and all of their friends at the mosque said they saw nothing. They can't believe that something was going on. But clearly something was going on. So that seems to be the critical missing link is, how do you identify that period of time when people become radicalized, when there's no outward appearance that it's happening?
So loss of life is unfortunate, whether it happens or it's caused by someone who claims to be Muslim. But I tell you, with the gun violence, and especially this year alone, FBI statistics indicate 355 mass murders in the U.S., and the last one was in California. So question is, I think we have to have a conversation. How do we tackle this, especially easy access to especially long-arm guns and assault weapons? So I think there's a connection. Radicalization is one, which I agree with you, but also easy access to assault weapons is another one where we need to have a conversation. And we really think that these people, whether they were, whatever their history, they need to be spotted, whether it's with the mental illness issue or it has to do with someone being radicalized by these violent ideologies. And I think FBI and the law enforcement official, they actually are doing a great job. We can do better. And Muslim American communities, along with other communities, I think all Americans have say something and reports if they see something, say something. So I think that is something which we need to really focus. How do we spot some of these criminal activities, whether they are in the making? And I think FBI, if you look at more than 60% of all these issues where of terrorism, actually were reported by, self-reported by Muslims and the Muslim mosques. You know.
Well, Ambassador Siddiqui, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Ambassador Islam Siddiqui, who's a former U.S. Undersecretary of Agriculture and Chief U.S. Agricultural Negotiator, who was the highest-ranking American Muslim in the Clinton and Obama administrations. He's currently Senior Advisor in the Global Food Security Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and the President and Co-Founder of the American Muslim Institution. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining the arguments before the Supreme Court today that challenge the very underpinning of the one-person, one-vote core of American democracy.
Sit down, man.
Glenn Beck.
Sit down, man.
Rand Paul.
Sit down, man.
LL Cool J.
Sit down, man.
Netanyahu.
Sit down, man.
Sarah Palin.
Sit down, man.
Newt Gingrich.
Sit down, man.
Toby Keith.
Sit down, man.
Here come the judge, don't nobody hurt. Cause here come the judge, Judge Shawnee is presiding today. And he don't take no stuff from nobody, no kind of way. Hey boy, take off that hat, where do you think you're at?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Elizabeth Wydra, who's the Chief Counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank, law firm, and action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution supports progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the Federal Courts of Appeals. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elizabeth Wydra.
It's great to be with you.
And Elizabeth, you were in the Supreme Court today where the justices heard arguments over the Texas case, which basically puts puts at stake the whole idea of one person, one vote. And as from what I understand from press reports, that the justices appeared skeptical about this conservative group's challenge to the method that Texas uses to draw up its state's legislature districts, because obviously this case has far-reaching consequences, because it would eventually, if it were to become law, would diminish the clout of people who live in cities, particularly Hispanic voters in Texas, and boost the power of rural voters who are more often than not Republicans. So let's start with the skeptical justices. Were on both the liberals and the conservatives appearing skeptical?
So this case would really revolutionize, in a bad way, the way that state and local legislative districts are drawn. Pretty much every state since the time of the 14th Amendment has been using the total population, that is, everyone who is a resident in a state, when they're drawing district lines, which makes sense because, you know, it's not just the people who cast their vote in the ballot box who are represented by our elected leaders, you know, but everyone who is subject to the laws. So we have children, we have residents who might not be able to vote. There are people who aren't voters but who are still represented in the government. And so skepticism came from both sides of the ideological divide on the Supreme Court. You know, first we had very powerful arguments from the more liberal justices like Justice Kagan and Justice Ginsburg, who said, look, the Constitution says when it comes to apportionment that you explicitly look to total population, not just the more limited group of eligible voters. And that was explicitly decided. It was a choice made by the drafters of the 14th Amendment. So you had skepticism based on those fundamental constitutional grounds. But then you also had some questions from the more conservative justices, like Justice Kennedy or Chief Justice Roberts, who said, you know, okay, but we don't really have the data about eligible voter populations. So even if we were going to try to go down that road, you know, we had sort of the kind of wonky census data folks file briefs saying that, you know, we just simply don't have the information in order to draw these more limited maps. So you basically need to have an entirely new census, and that would throw up into disarray all of the way that districts are currently drawn. And, you know, I think it's important to note that, as you suggested, perhaps the reason behind this lawsuit for the people who brought it is that it would result, at least right now, in a power shift to white rural voters who tend to vote Republican and take away power from more urban areas, and particularly Latino voters.
And it's not just the large Latino populations in cities like Los Angeles and cities in Texas as well. And it's not just children. It's also felons, right, who would not be counted. My understanding is that's become quite a substantial number of people who've had their voting rights taken away from them in this country.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, you're talking about, you know, I think one of the, you're not just talking about people who are currently incarcerated, because that could be counted in, under total population, and because, unfortunately, of mass incarceration, you know, you do have districts where there is a substantial prison population. But exactly, there are people who have served their time, but because of state law, they are disenfranchised, which is entirely, you could have an entirely other show about that and the injustices there. But yes, people who are subject to the law, who have served their time but are currently disenfranchised under state law, would not be counted. And that's just not the way that our Constitution works. We, you know, we have the idea that it is the total population that is the principle of equal representation, that everyone is represented in the government. And Justice Ginsburg, I thought, asked a great question. So, you know, she asked the supporters of this more limited population idea, the folks who are bringing this challenge to one person, one vote, and said, so are you saying that it would have been appropriate not to count women during the time before 1920, before women got the right to vote? And basically he said, yeah, you wouldn't have counted women. So the idea that you would say that this entire portion of the population is not going to be counted when it comes to representation, that's just, I think, contrary to basic constitutional values and certainly Supreme Court precedent.
And again, I'm speaking with Elizabeth Wydra, who's the Chief Counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank, law firm, and action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution supports progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the Federal Courts of Appeals, and was in the Supreme Court this morning when the justices heard the Texas challenge to redistricting or drawing up new voting rules brought by Sue Evanwell and Edward Feniger and the Project on Fair Representation. And I'd like to talk to you about this group, who's had an inordinate influence over some recent Supreme Court decisions. And there's another one coming up tomorrow that they've brought to the court as well. But just to touch on what you just said, doesn't that mean, for example, that the President of the United States and U.S. senators who represent whole states, my understanding is that they see themselves as representing all of the people, not just the people that voted for them. Is that also a principle in American democracy?
Yeah, absolutely. That was precisely what the drafters of the 14th Amendment, when they were writing about equal protection and writing about apportionment of representation, said that, you know, the total population is represented by our government, and that includes people who didn't vote for the person who ultimately won the election. That includes people who simply just don't cast a ballot. It counts for people who are unable to cast a ballot. They are subject to our laws. They have a voice in the government through their representatives. And, you know, there was this suggestion, which I found rather shocking, that, you know, we don't have to worry about not counting children, for example, because they're represented at the polls by their parents. And that brought a rebuke from Justice Breyer, who said, you know, I think at the time of the colonies, we had this idea of, oh, don't worry, Parliament in England will represent you, you know, you'll be okay. And that's just sort of not how things work, you know. Everyone who is subject to our laws is represented by our elected leaders, whether they voted for them or not, whether they could vote for them or not. And that's just, you know, contrary to constitutional principles to say that equal representation based on total population is not how things should work.
So let's talk about these plaintiffs who brought this challenge to the Supreme Court, obviously challenging Texas law initially, but as you pointed out, Elizabeth Wydra, it has profound implications for the entire electorate, and it could change the entire way that the people are represented in this country. If they're just represented from up until now, they've been represented based upon the whole population, but then if that's changed to those who are eligible to vote, that's a whole new ball game. And these characters, Sue Evanwell and Edward Feniger, belong to a small conservative advocacy group called the Project on Fair Representation. But they've had an inordinate impact already on the Supreme Court and on the country. They're the ones who brought Shelby County versus Holder, which they won in 2013, which struck down the heart of the Voting Rights Act that arguably was an act of tremendous partisanship and very successful on the part of this small group of people, including these two plaintiffs. And tomorrow the Supreme Court is hearing another case that they've brought, which is the case involving admissions to universities, which they're also the plaintiffs in, challenging the use of racial preferences in university admissions. So how do you explain this? I know there's this phenomenon called Supreme Court shopping, but it looks like these two are professional Supreme Court shoppers.
Well, you know, it's really interesting because, as you noted, Ed Blum, who is who's not a lawyer, but he has an organization that does recruit plaintiffs like Sue Evanwell in this particular case and funds the legal efforts behind their cases, really has, and I don't know why, but has really sort of engaged in this campaign to rewrite our Constitution's broad guarantee of equality through these various cases, seeking to, you know, sharply limit affirmative action, race-conscious efforts in higher education intended to increase diversity and decrease racial isolation and stereotypes. He's brought cases that, as we saw in the case argued just today in the Supreme Court, trying to exclude immigrants and children and others from equal representation in the legislature. And as we saw in Shelby County, he was fighting to take what was the crown jewel of our civil rights legislation, the Voting Rights Act, and gut that by saying that, you know, one of the most important protections against racial discrimination in voting was no longer necessary, which we know to be absolutely untrue and has been proven, unfortunately, since that case was handed down. So I think that he is on this campaign to really turn the 14th Amendment, which is one of the most majestic guarantees of equality in our Constitution, turn it instead into an obstacle to efforts to ensure real equality and deny the government the power to hold people responsible for racial discrimination and try to prevent discrimination. And so we will see tomorrow yet another case, the Fisher versus University of Texas case, which Ed Blum's group is behind, which is trying to once and for all get rid of affirmative action in college admissions. That's what the University of Texas case. So, you know, it's certainly he has had a very outsized influence in the Supreme Court. And, you know, obviously the Supreme Court is not required to take these cases, but he certainly is hitting a nerve in the conservative legal community that these cases not only make their way up the court, but that the court accepts them.
Well, what explains that, though? What do you know about Ed Blum and who funds his organization, the Project on Fair Representation?
Well, it's difficult to get information about, you know, who exactly his funders are. He himself, I think is a failed politician. And so, you know, perhaps he finds it much easier to get what he wants through the courts than through getting his fellow citizens to vote the way that he wants, which, you know, I would think this Supreme Court would have some issues with, since Supreme Court Chief Justice Roberts has said that he doesn't want the court to be seen as, you know, a place that is just politics as usual. But, you know, certainly people are free to engage in impact litigation. You know, we on the left have done that for causes for civil rights and equality. I don't think that's at all what he is doing. But, you know, I think it is important to know whether these cases are being brought because there is a real harm that's being experienced by the people, or whether it is a political agenda. And, you know, I think the affirmative action case that's going to be heard tomorrow is perhaps a good example of that. You know, a lot of the policy experts show that having race-conscious admissions policies that lead to diversity in higher education are, in fact, good for all students, both students of color and for white students, and good for the nation and economy as a whole. And then you have a plaintiff who's bringing the case who has already graduated from college, who the University of Texas said wouldn't have been admitted anyway, even without the race-conscious admissions program. And so, you know, that's just perhaps a suggestion that there isn't really a real harm there, but instead this is more of an ideological fight.
Well, the fact that the same people keep bringing cases to the Supreme Court and winning them, not that they necessarily won the case today that you observed the arguments on, Elizabeth Wydra, that on the surface is absurd, isn't it? I mean, you know, there are different people who have different grievances that may or may not end up in the Supreme Court. And And you're right to point out that the key to the Supreme Court is what cases they accept. And they seem to accept an awful lot of Ed Blum's cases. So this is a pretty extraordinary story, to my mind.
You know, I think if you look at the trend in racial justice cases in the Supreme Court, with headed by Chief Justice Roberts, you know, he certainly has generally been less than friendly to claims that seek to advance racial justice and equality. And Ed Blum's litigation seems to tap into that spirit of the conservative legal movement that is critical of efforts to combat racial discrimination through civil rights laws, whether it's the Voting Rights Act or housing laws. Sometimes they're not successful, fortunately. You know, we've seen Justice Kennedy break from the more conservative justices, and the question, I think, certainly in the affirmative action case tomorrow, will be whether he will break from the conservatives and vote again to uphold diversity in higher education. I think today, with the total population, one person, one vote case, whether the spirit of equal representation that is embodied in the Constitution, in the 14th Amendment, whether that will prevail. And I think that, you know, we have justices who are concerned about practicality. Chief Justice Roberts was concerned about whether Evan Wells' proposed eligible voter population is even possible to discern through data we currently have, because the census doesn't ask about citizenship, for example. So, you know, Ed Blum is not always successful in the Supreme Court, and hopefully these cases will be a time when he is handed a defeat and not a victory.
But if, for example, they won, and the census would therefore have to completely revamp what they do, and the next one's not till 2020. So there's certain practicalities involved here. But this surely would lead to a two Americas, won't it? The one in the daylight and the one in the shadows.
Well, I think it certainly was never contemplated by the Constitution that you would have substantial groups of people excluded from having a voice in government, excluded from representation. You know, as Justice Ginsburg opened the arguments this morning, equal representation is the principle of the Constitution. And so that's really what's at stake in this case, and it's incredibly important. You know, I think obviously we have the practicality issues. The government today and Texas did suggest that this might require a new census, because the kind of data we have just is not there. But I think even more important would be the massive shift in our principles of representation and equality, the idea that you could exclude vast portions of the population from having a say in our government, from being deemed as eligible for equal representation. That would be a big shift and incredibly unfortunate.
Well, Elizabeth Wadra, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Elizabeth Wadra, who's the chief counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank, law firm, and action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution supports progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the federal courts of appeals, and was in the Supreme Court this morning when they heard the case brought by these plaintiffs who want to overturn the one person, one vote rule or tradition in American democracy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at ianmasters.com, where you can contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.